One of the profound things we can all say is, here we are. Here. And we share some things in common being here. We share being on the retreat. We're here at this retreat. And we're here about halfway through the retreat, in the halfway place. We're here as human beings, with beating hearts, a full collection of antennas, or sensory capacity to sense each other, know ourselves, know the world in all the different ways. We're here, alive and with these things operating. It's a phenomenal thing to be here. And it's, you know, somewhat sad how easy it is to not be here. People who spend a long time living in the past, long time living in the future, long time living in fantasy. But to really be here, it's one of the, and to know what it's like to be here fully as a human being, and to allow our humanity to really, all the goodness, all the wealth of our humanity to be here in a way that helps us feel deeply at peace. Or more important than at peace, maybe at home. At home in this world, at home in ourselves. Sometimes I think that one of the great practices would be simply to remind yourself regularly that you're here. Here. So much would become clear if you just kept showing up here, here, here. This is what it's like to be alive now. This is the experience of now. And you've been doing this for these days of the retreat, offering a sincere effort to be here. And it turns out to be a bit of a journey to arrive here, and sometimes it takes a long time to, we arrive in pieces, we arrive in degrees. Sometimes we're kind of here, and sometimes we're really here. All of who we are is present here, and we're not fragmented, or part of us is not concerned about other times and other places, but we're here, fully. And we're here so fully that we have dropped many of the ways that keep us at a distance from ourselves, keep us from a distance from the world, shut off or distracted with our judgments or fears that we have. We're here. And there's a number of great tasks to work for human beings, I think all of us, to work through so we can really be here. And one of them is to figure out our relationship to community and belonging. Where do we belong? How do we belong? Many people have a lot of suffering around not belonging, feeling outside of their community or family or anything. There's a deep need in human beings to feel part of community. Some have more need, some have less need. Some have had their need met so fully that they don't have to think about it anymore. Just, it's kind of who they are, in a sense. They feel at home here. They've worked through the whole challenge of belonging, what that's about. And then there's the big task of self-worth, self-value, of feeling that you're valuable and you're important, you have worth. And that can be, for some people, a task of a lifetime. But to discover that, you know, that we're our inherent value, that we're important, that we can value ourselves and cherish ourselves, that we have worth. Ideally, that's taught to us from the time we start breathing. And so it's deeply embedded in our psyche. And so at some point, we're so at home in ourselves that it's no longer a concern. It becomes invisible, maybe even because it's not needed anymore. But a great task. It's a noble task. It's a great task to discover ourselves here and feel that here we have worth, we have value. To know it. Another task that people need in order to really, some people need to really kind of arrive here and be here in a full way, confident way, is they need to heal their relationships, heal their, the broken relationships, the pain, the distance, the process of reconciliation, or healing in themselves. We've done something in our lives that caused harm and creates a kind of fracture in our own heart, fracture in the relationship in the world. And so it's one of the great noble tasks of life is to heal those, to reconcile. And some people, that's kind of what's needed to really be here at home, fully here. Can't really be at home in ourselves sometimes if we feel, oh, something's not quite right. And we see it sometimes when people are dying. And like in hospitals, people sometimes are dying. And it seems like what they most want to do is not go on a meditation retreat and breathe mindfully. But they want a long estranged family member to come visit them. And so they, after 20 years, they could ask for forgiveness, offer forgiveness, somehow have a reconciliation so when they die they can somehow feel complete, feel whole, something. It's a great task of a lifetime. And then there's sometimes what the task is to have a sense of meaning and purpose in life. To feel like your life has meaning or direction or purpose. And that can be a big task. To discover that. For some people it's a task that they set out to find when they leave home, 18, 19, 20, or whatever it might be, to find what their purpose is in life. And to know your purpose and to feel connected to it is another way of feeling at home and be here. Here we are. And it isn't that we have to have purpose or meaning or like there's some moral or some, you know, ethical thing, we have to have it. But it's, I think what, there's the heart's wish, the inner wish, to be able to live in this world and feel at home in it, feel at home in ourselves. If some of these things are not quite taken care of, it's hard to really settle and be here. And when people do this kind of practice, sometimes what they come up against is places where it's difficult to settle. And some people try to go around it. Some people try to kind of, I've known people who have actually kind of used meditation and retreats like this as a way to bypass trying to take care of those things. And, you know, the world out there is difficult and there's problems, and so they kind of want to go and come here and somehow use their samadhi to bust right through it or override it or something. But this idea of learning to sit confidently here at home in yourself so that you can be at peace and still, so the mind doesn't have to be agitated or caught or afraid, to really sit here and be quiet and still. It's a beautiful task to do. And so these teachings we've done this week so far, you know, are important parts of this process. The loving kindness and body, speech, and mind have a lot to do with our relationships and our belonging and our community. And sometimes we find belonging not by endlessly hoping that other people invite us in to their community, but we find community by inviting everybody into our hearts. Maybe we're already community, we're already family. And something, when our heart, our love, our loving kindness gets large enough, there's something different can happen, that when we say, yes, you're part of my community, I don't have to wait for you to invite me to be part of yours. Or loving kindness also is a way of working through some of the challenges we have, and find a different society to live in. It can be a fantastic sense of purpose and meaning in life and sense of worth to be committed to a community that life, where there's goodwill and friendliness and mutual care. And it's so wonderful that these six principles of cordiality starts with three whole steps having to do with loving kindness. Three of the six is phenomenal. It's so important. And then the next one that Ruth talked about yesterday is sharing, generosity. This also clearly has to do with our community life, our relationships with each other. And nothing's been said yet about meditating. And there's something about the practice and the spirit of generosity that also does a lot in this field of our sense of community, our healing of relationships, healing of ourselves, sense of meaning and purpose in our life, sense of value, self-value. It leads to a sense of efficacy that, yes, it's not hopeless. We can do things. We can make a difference. We don't have to wait. We're not waiting to be given our life. If you're waiting to be given your life, you'll be waiting a long, long time. But you have to live your life, and one of the ways to have efficacy and a place in the world is to be generous, is to give, to share yourself with the world. And then the next step, the fifth principle of cordiality is to live a life of virtue. And I like the word virtue. The word is sila, and we could say like life of ethics or life of the precepts or something. But I don't know how this lands on your ears to hear the word virtue. But for me, it's a very rich word. It's full of texture and flavor and aroma. It's like a good stew that's really been stewed and on a cold day, and it's warm and it smells, all these wonderful smells of herbs and all the vegetables. And it's just like so fully embodied. You know, the stew is fully embodied. So the word virtue has that kind of fullness. It's like steeped and saturated and pervaded and cooked for it, millennia. And it's all these wonderful things, you know. I mean, it's not just ethics, but it's one of the definitions of virtue, I think, in Western philosophy, is the things that the moral qualities that help bring out excellence in people. Isn't that great? Excellence in people. Or human thriving. It really makes us thrive. And I loved Ruth's discussion, definition of virtue yesterday. I don't know if I can probably do justice to remembering it, but then it's the action that brings benefit to others. And benefit to self and others. And so we're going to get tomorrow, Ruth's turn, where it's going to talk about, finally, what we think Buddhism is all about. You know, about liberation and, you know, the little thing, you know, it's kind of tacked on at the end. Liberation and freedom and emancipation and all that. But before we get there, these five other things that are going on that have to be about being in community. And virtue has a lot to do about being community. Most virtues, and certainly most ethical virtues in Buddhism, are all about our relationship to each other. I used to think that the precepts were just like tacked on as good rules that you're supposed to follow. It's like abstract ideas. But now I think of them as they're ways of caring for our relationship with each other. And so all these things, you know, central things about being a human being here, you know, has a lot to do with these relations, caring for them and having them being healthy and good. So fifth principle, or cordiality, or of heartwood. Or one person translates this as six principles of delight. No one quite knows how this word is supposed to be translated. So one dwells in public and in private with one's companions in the holy life, with those virtues that are unbroken, untorn, unblotched, unmodeled, liberating, commended by the wise, not misapprehended, and then one more thing. So three, this is all part of the stew, right? All the things that go into making it. Because it's been stewing for centuries and millennia. It becomes unbroken, untorn, unblotched, unmodeled, liberating. So in public and private, one lives in common with one's companions with virtue that are time honored. Societies have honored them for a decade, centuries. And these things bring cordiality. These principles create love, respect, unity, concord, all these wonderful things. So the virtue. So then the part that I didn't want to read right away. So there's an interesting turning that goes on here in the whole direction of what we've seen so far. So it says, lives with these virtues that are unbroken, untorn, unblotched, and so forth, and conducive to concentration. Isn't that great? Conducive to concentration. So, you know, so much of these principles of cordiality have to do with our relationship and creating good, you know, concord and love and respect and all that. And here, this one is the first time in the list where it talks about those virtues that not only are good for society, but also help you get concentrated. And so what is concentration? I think of concentration as the ability to be here in a full way, to be composed and confident here. I don't know if you know this, but confidence is one of the characteristics of the jhanas. The second jhana, second level of concentration, one has self-confidence and singleness of mind in this state. Just kind of sit with self-confidence. And singleness of mind doesn't quite work for me. It's a kind of evocative word in the stew. But I like the word gather together into one, composed, we're whole, the idea of being complete. And part of the idea of concentration is not this laser-like focus that zeroes in on things, but rather to become complete and whole and be composed and settled here, to be here. And so the desperate communities that are within us can become whole and complete and be here, settled. So we're not fragmented within. Just as the six principles of cordiality help create or heal the fragmentation of our society, so virtue helps concentration helps really settle this fragmentation of communities within us, our internalized communities and different ways we are. So virtue turns out, at least from the teachings of the Buddha, to be important for our community, and it's important for people, for ourselves. And we can do it for both the sake of our community and for the sake of ourselves. And so what we see, the way this list is unfolds, and this is often the case with lists in the Buddhist teachings, is it's kind of a progression that we go through. And so the progression is first loving-kindness in action. Sometimes it's easiest to act. It's easier to act than it is to have a good attitude. You can act out, you can act. It's big, big things. And so in a gross way, we can act with kindness. And then it's harder to do it with our speech. It's hard to be mindful of speech. So we develop it first where it's easiest in acts. You know, we can plan, you know, years in advance to, you know, to do a kind act to someone. You know, I think that I'm not going to see that person for a year, but I think I can prepare myself so I can open the door for them. You know, I don't have to say anything to them. I don't have to think anything good about them. I just have to open that door. But then it's a little more challenging to figure out what to say. That's expression of goodwill. So, you know, so it takes more of ourselves. So it's the journey goes into what's more difficult, or deeper, or more integral. And then more integral, deeper is the third step is goodwill in our minds. You know, that has to do with attitudes, our attitudes of heart. You know, kind of what's really going on in there, and how to care for that and tend that. And then if this kind of progression works, then sharing ourselves, giving things to people and sharing our lives in common, that's a kind of a deeper aspect. We settle in deeper, we feel a heartfelt connection, we share ourselves with others, hold things in common. I think it says, you know, you share even the food from your alms bowl. We don't recommend that we start sharing each other's plates of food here, but this makes it a little complicated on a retreat, but really to share. That was one of the important things for me when I was, first time I left home to be on my own traveling around with friends. I was 17 and we hardly had any money. And it was a formative experience for me that the five of us, we shared everything. Everything we shared. All our money, whatever food we had, whatever clothes we had, whatever we shared. As we traveled about. And this idea that we're kind of like family and sharing, felt very profound. We're not protecting ourselves and so much holding on to what's mine, me, myself, and mine. So it's a journey to go from what's kind of supposedly more easier or more obvious to that's what's deeper inside of us. And then virtue is even deeper still, because virtue is not just how we behave, but it's deep attitudes, capacity for compassion and empathy. maybe I can't find it easily. Yeah, I want to read. I think it's a beautiful passage where it talks about abstaining from killing, but dwelling compassionately. Abstaining from stealing, but dwelling with, you know, generosity and respect and all these things, all these good qualities we can develop. And so it's a journey, you know, to something deeper and deeper. And here with the virtues, a deep thing. And here in the retreat, we've done a journey. These days are a journey. You're probably different today than you were on Saturday. Different today than you were a week ago. Different today than you were the first day when I asked how many of you had headaches and had pain. I'm sure some of you still do, but comes and goes. But you know, I think it's probably, you're probably in a very different place where you are, where you've come to just through this unfolding. And it's a great thing to settle, to arrive, to be here more, to a greater degree. And there's a mutual relationship between being settled, being concentrated, and virtue. That the more concentrated we become, most people become more virtuous. It's very hard if you become really settled on yourself in a peaceful, full, soft, nice way to be here. And it's really hard to want to lie or steal or do something that fractures our community and our relationship with others. It tends to kind of be really settled and at home and have our heart feels kind of safe and open and kind of singing and vibrant and confident. We tend to bring out the best in people, our goodness, how we want to relate to people. And then it's the other way too, that if we live with virtue, we live with compassion and caring for our community and live with generosity and integrity, and that then we're not so fragmented, we're not so at conflict with ourselves, our conscience is not troubled. And so then it's easier and easier to settle and just be here. And so sometimes we need to kind of spend some time looking at our virtue, looking at our behavior, looking at, you know, our speech. I doubt many of you are robbing banks regularly, so we have to deal with that one. But there might be subtle ways in which, I don't know if subtle, but there are ways where your ethics could be improved. Not because we're being moralistic or puritanical so much, as because it feels right, because it feels like that's how you can become complete, that's how you become whole, that's how you become healed, that's how you care for yourself and care for others, that's how you thrive, that's how, you know, what's beautiful in you can just kind of sing here. And so to spend time looking at your speech, is your speech ethical? Do you gossip? Do you speak badly about people? Talk about behind their back? Are you cynical too much? Do you practice slander? Is it harsh, your speech sometimes? How often do you speak out of anger in a way that's hurtful for others? How do you speak to yourself? Do you have a good ethical relationship with yourself? I think a lot of people who come on retreats are pretty ethical people towards everyone except the one. It's often, you know, very critical and angry and, you know, something towards oneself. And so, you know, practicing virtuous speech, wise speech in your mind as you talk to yourself or think about yourself. So there's probably room there to clean it up. And one way to speak, to come to kind of a nicer relationship to yourself is to free yourself from spiritual obligation. You know, religion has a huge kind of parental weight on many people's shoulders, like the, you know, the religion's like the big parent in the sky or somewhere. It has all this authority. It's parent substitute or something as we get older. Or something like that. And it often comes with, some religions come with a very strong, you know, they're going to tell you how you're supposed to live your life. This is how you have to do it. If you're going to be a good human being, this is what it takes. You've got to do it. Otherwise, the consequences are going to be pretty dire for you. Watch out. But I think Buddhism, I have a PhD in Buddhism, so I have a little bit of authority to have an opinion around these things. And I've studied this for a long time and looked at it. And to the best of my ability, my understanding, Buddhism obligates us to do nothing. There's no obligation in Buddhism. It's not a religion of obligation. And so this, you know, the teachings of Buddhism has about virtue, about ethics, you're not obligated to be ethical. There's not required, you know, some kind of metaphysical way, or it's like big, you know, authority figure in the sky, the Buddha, and some, you know, the tradition, thou shalt, you have to be, this is what you should do. Because if you have that kind of attitude, then it's really easy to add a whole bunch of weight on yourself, a whole bunch of criticism, and feel like you're fundamentally wrong as a person, and because of something, you know. It's like, but what I understand, that Buddhism doesn't obligate us to do anything, but it does say that if you want to become free, this is what it takes. So there's a kind of a requirement for the purpose of freedom. If you want to be free, don't kill, don't steal, don't lie. If you want to be free. But it's not an obligation. It's just like no one's obligated to, I don't know what a good example would be. No one's obligated to learn to swim. But if you want to learn to swim, you're required to practice. You know, you don't want to just throw yourself into the deep end without practicing on the shallow end first, and kind of, if you want to learn to swim, you're required to practice, you know, get some lessons. So, but it's not an obligation to learn to swim. So if you want your heart to heal, if you want your heart to sing, to be confident in this world, there's many things, then these are things you can do. You can live a virtuous life. And so it's an opportunity. The teachings on ethics in Buddhism are more an opportunity that you can pick up than an obligation you have to do. And in terms of these things, that belonging, healing, purpose in life, reconciliation, self-worth, to pick up these opportunities, to choose to pick these opportunities up, and to do so in such a way that we feel the opportunity to create a better world, a better self. This is one of the great things in life. This is healing. It brings all these good things. It does a lot of the important work for being human. If it's an obligation to do all this, you're supposed to practice, you're supposed to be ethical, then, oh yeah, well, I succeeded. That was good. That was good. that was a close one, boy. That's not very inspiring. But to pick up the opportunity of ethics, of virtue, and sharing, and loving kindness, and compassion, and all the different virtues you can live by, I mean, that's inspiring. Well, pick it up and live it. It's a great thing. So it's been a journey here on the retreat. And I suspect that overall, it goes up and down the course of the day, overall you probably feel more grounded in yourself, a little more quiet or settled on yourself than when you came on Saturday. And with that comes a variety of different, you know, all kinds of things. An analogy I gave someone today, what it's like to be on retreat, to this practice, is you've been away from your house for a long, long time, and changed a little bit in how I told the person, but all your dogs and cats, turtles have, you know, had free reign of the house. But they were locked out of the living room that you walk into when you first come in. So your living room is all clean. You come in, oh, so nice to be home. The living room is all neat and nice. And then you open the kitchen door, and the kitchen is a total mess. And sometimes even the dogs really got crazy and they tore off the cabinet doors looking for food. And so. You know, you thought things were really great with the living room, like settled, and then you have to, so you have to go in there and you have to clean up the kitchen. And it isn't like you're going backward, it isn't like you're regressing by going into the kitchen. It means that you're going forward, you have to clean it up. And then, you know, maybe they stayed out of the bathroom. Maybe that was part of the problem. And so that bathroom is in good shape. Wow, you know, you go in there and you sit there and look. Wow, it's so nice and peaceful here and so clean. And this is like samadhi. But then you go into the bedroom and so you have to clean that up. So we're like a house, and we have all these rooms. And some of those rooms, maybe, you know, you come into the first day of the retreat, and it's not the nice living room, but it's like, you know, you have to do a lot of cleaning up in that. But then maybe by the third day you come into a nice room, or you've cleaned up a room and you enjoy the room, it's clean, but then you end up going to the next room and it turns out to be messy. So then you have to clean that room up. So it goes up and down on retreat. But overall, the process, I think it's fair to say generally that there is a kind of intimacy or connectedness or groundedness and solidity. And I'd like to use the word confidence, not so much that you necessarily have it from this practice, but if I use the word enough, maybe you'll start, you know, thinking about being confident. Maybe you haven't thought about it enough. To be confident. Be here, connected, grounded here. And this intimacy and this heightened sensitivity, heightened awareness of ourselves, heightened awareness of our body, heightened awareness of our mind, heightened awareness of our heart. The higher quality, the quality of our heart, as I said, is our wealth. So how do we care for it? Many people ask it coming to the end of a retreat, you know, how do I bring this into my daily life? And I think they're often thinking that, sometimes they ask explicitly, well, you know, instructions of how they can sit every day. And that's nice, but they often don't expect to hear the instructions, live your virtue, live virtuously more, share a life in common in a virtuous way, ethically, which means do the things which are beneficial for your community and for yourself. Pay attention to your community and see how you can live with the community in a caring way, in a harmonious way. Who is it in the community you live in that you're not noticing? Who is in the community that you do notice? Does that represent a fissure in your community? And can you overcome that fissure? Can you expand your community to include the people you tend not to notice, tend not to interact with? There's an opportunity to live virtue there. Share generosity, live in common. The language here is the life we live in common. One of the things I'm trying to say here or get across is that to be here, connected in yourself, whole, feeling complete, it's very closely connected to virtue, to being virtuous, to our ethics, to our how we are in relationship to the world in a caring way. And that by making this connection strong, making a strong connection between these two, that it becomes easier to relax and settle and be at home here. To really come here and be at home in a deep way. Remember, you go in through the water and you come out through the fire or something. This idea of you go in and you get turned inside out. To go in and really be at home, it might seem selfish to come here and be settled and at home, confidently, upright, here. But we do it and we get turned inside out. And the sense of being, the boundary between self and others kind of begin to become porous. And we feel much easier sense of connectedness to the world around us. I find it is a great lesson to be on retreat with other people. And sometimes on retreats, you don't talk to anyone. Someone's sitting there, you don't talk to them. You don't know anything, you don't even know their name. But after a week of retreat, you feel close to them. You feel kind of like, oh, there's just my special person. Look, you feel connected. Not because you were thinking about them or focusing on them, because somehow this being turned inside out. You're so settled on yourself, so here, that we're no longer kind of caught up in our self-preoccupations. And the body's relaxed a little bit, the heart's relaxed a little bit, and there's a heightened sensitivity, and we take in people, and we feel them. I don't know if this is a good example, but I'll say it, even though it might not be wise. I once sat next to this woman on retreat. She's sitting right next to me. And I became acutely aware of her breathing. And that's how I fell in love with her. And we were partners for a couple of years. It was very nice. But there was that, I don't know if that's the usual way of falling in love. In case you're looking for a partner, don't start tuning in to people's breathing. Because it might be something else, it might be their socks. So what I'm trying to say is this idea of really settling on yourself and really being here, being willing to somehow relax. Relax all the ways in which, all the tensions that propel your thinking. To relax and settle all the tensions that propel some of your emotional responses and reactions to things. To relax some of all the restlessness that might be in your body, in your legs, in your hands, in your arms, your shoulders, to kind of get you to move and to jump around. To settle all these things and settle in. Into the place inside, if there is such a place for you, this makes sense, a place where your goodness is, place where your wholeness is, place where your virtue is, place where empathy is, or the place where being at home is, being at home in yourself. It's a great thing to trust this, to value this, to settle in here, come here. And then to live from that place, I think it becomes pretty natural to live ethically, pretty natural to live a life of virtue. Generally, people are unethical when they don't feel at home in themselves, when they feel disconnected from themselves and agitated and kind of preoccupied with desires and aversions and things, and preoccupied with fear and protecting themselves. So the natural virtue that's within us when we are at home in ourselves. And then to be at home in ourselves, to discover that capacity. And then the great thing is to learn to carry that with us anywhere we go. So it's not a matter of having a home where we feel at home, but carrying it with us. It's not a matter of waiting for someone else to do something for us or behave properly. But we already feel whole, we already feel complete, we already feel a certain kind of safety in the world. We don't wait for someone else to make us safe. There's something about the Buddha called awakening, freedom, liberation, the ultimate security, the ultimate safety. And it's a little bit of a koan, it's a little bit of a, you know, challenging topic. What does it mean to discover ultimate safety that you can carry with you? So we don't require other people, depend on other people to be safe. What does that look like? How does that work? How does it work in a world where the people do terrible things to each other? What is it to be find inner safety that can go with you anywhere? So it's a great, noble, dignified, valuable undertaking that you do when you come to a retreat like this. If all you did was spend these days in silence, just that would be a noble, dignified, valuable thing to do. There's something that happens in the field of silence that things begin with kind of a deeper connectedness, intimacy, heightened awareness, self-knowledge that begins to arise and happen in this. We're not distracted from ourselves. It's a great thing to do to human life. And then on top of that, we add the mindfulness. Yeah, heightened interest, heightened paying attention to what's actually going on. What is going on? What's happening here? What's happening in this body and the breath? What's happening? And to have that question added to the practice of here is maybe all you need. To be here. What's happening here? What's going on? Not to analyze, not to think about it, but to sense it, to be present for it. Someone in the interviews taught me a new English word this week. I forget who it was. They said the word presenting. I turned present into a verb. I thought it was lovely. Presenting. So here we are. Presenting our experience to discover what it is to be whole. So let's. It's a way of transitioning, ending this talk. Let me go back into your meditation posture for a couple of minutes. to be here. With inner confidence. To be here confidently. You belong. You're valuable. You can find a purpose. And healing is possible. Here. Confident.